Who here does not speak Dutch? Okay, that's enough. There's enough people that don't speak Dutch. They'll do this in English. I really didn't really prepare anything. I don't have slides. I'm not going to talk much. I'm tired. I'm glad to see so many people interested in this Bob session. It's about Vim, so if you're not here for Vim, you're in the wrong room. Everybody?
Sorry.
this Bob is actually about Vim 7. I'm not going to talk about the old stuff. I'm going to talk about the new stuff. What is coming. And the only preparation I did was print out some votes. You know, people that sponsor Vim, well, they actually sponsor me, not Vim. They can vote for features. So I made a list of features. It's not very boring, like stop adding features. Or increased PI compatibility. And some fancy ones, like at IntelliSense completion. IDE features, improve folding, well, hoping. Maybe you can just pass them around.
Sure.
I'm not sure if there's enough for everybody, so maybe you'll have to share.
How about sharing when it's sort of 4 or 5 done?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. If you're together, just only take one. Actually, I should have one myself. Hold on.
I want it back.
You have only one for 3, so maybe I can do it. You can see this is not organized. I'm planning to do a lot of work on Vim 7. And at the moment I don't have another job. I do things like organizing the bazaar and other parts of this conference. But I'm relying on sponsors and other things to keep me fed. And so I can spend more time with Vim. And at least I'll try to keep up with all the bug reports. But that's not very interesting to talk about tonight, so let's not do that. What I'd like to know is what people want to see in Vim 7. And also a little bit about how to implement that, because there's a lot of choices to be made. If you look at the voting list, then the top feature being asked for is context-sensitive completion or IntelliSense completion. Somebody has an idea how to do that?
Yeah? Just an observation from the Eclipse project. They wrote their own Java compiler. You know, I mean, it's not something you can do generically, I don't think. Well, maybe there's a generic framework or interface.
Uh-huh.
But if you look at Eclipse, then it's just about, it's famous as a Java ID. It's not a Java ID at all, it's a platform. Everything's done via extensions. Only extension, standard extension, the editor extension. The editor extension relies on the Java compiler, which the implement supply, to provide hints to the editor.
So what you're saying is, you actually need a compiler, or at least a large part of the compiler,
yeah,
the parser, to understand the language, to do good kind of completion.
Yeah, yeah. And it has to be reliable.
Yeah.
You know, you can't say, oh, the rest of it. It has to be correct, so you have to do it properly. That's present.
And I suppose Eclipse, or the compiler that comes with it, is using the class files, so the pre-compiled Java files to search for class definitions. And
I think it adds debug information as such, you know, to, and then I believe it actually compiles from source. I mean, this is not something I've used before, I've read about it before, but it's not source, and it's got a special name to that particular project. But I'm sure it's an extensible model because it will.
Yeah, so it's a very easy language because the class Eclipse itself you can use to enumerate certain language methods and all.
I'm not sure about the license there, but perhaps an initial implementation could use that very compiler supplied with Eclipse and implement a TeleSense in Vim.
Same goes for Python. Python is also a self-reflecting language. So if you start the interpreter, for instance, you import some module, you can then ask that module to give a dictionary of all the methods and symbols it has. And the same goes for functions.
I think actually Python would be simple if you have Python there.
Indeed.
So you just ask the Python interpreter to do the listing of the possible completions.
Right? Indeed. And what good would it be to have Python completion without having Python itself?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, yeah.
That would be weird to write a Python program if you don't have a Python interpreter.
Indeed.
It's the same way in Pickle Shell if you have command line completions.
Mm-hmm.
Pickle in line extension. It actually asks the interpreter for what's valid at that point and gets it back and then calls it back.
You make a list of languages that could be used that way?
Yeah.
I was actually thinking if you're planning to do it extensively, like the scripting languages and other plugins that you can use these days, rather than having sort of core with, or make it maintainable less. A lot of things are dependent by maintaining.
Yes, I certainly think it should go that way, so that there's not just C code that does the work, because then you'll probably get stuck very quickly, and it's an awful thing to like re-implement the Java compiler or what it's doing, because that's basically what you have to do it reliably. Find some way to do a plugin for IntelliSense, and then using the compiler or whatever is doing the parsing to then a lower level, some kind of interface to Vim.
And maybe, maybe you should look at readline interface, which is actually gives you API for command completion. But if you use readline, you just tell them these are what can be done.
But does readline do completion for things like Java or Python?
It does generic completion.
No, so it's just for the interface. The
indeed.
Idea.
Yeah.
On the Vim development list, a couple of months ago, half a year, I thought there was something about somebody who made completion for Windows that was working with Vim,
actually,
if I remember correctly.
I don't have time to look into how it works, but yeah, somebody wrote a script to do some kind of completion. Did anybody use it? Try that.
Well, excuse me for my ignorance. Context-sensitive
confusion. Okay, good question. Some people are lost here. The idea is that while you're typing your source code, you can complete things like variable names that have been used in the header file.
So that's for every language
on itself? It's very language sensitive. Mm-hmm. It goes further that when you refer to a certain class, then you type after that dot something, and the start of a method or the start of a member of that class, and you get completion, you get a list of the possible members of the class. Possibly
you want to go beyond just syntax.
Oh, yes. And, I think it's important to have a reliable kind of thing, not just guessing it might be this or it might be that, but the complete list. It's this or nothing else.
Yeah, indeed.
Is that true?
Yeah. Computers do well is grunt work. You know, they do tedious, repetitive tasks very well. And tedious, repetitive tasks are going back and checking any arguments. They're fucking bunch of computers do that well, so let's teach them to do it. And there's arguments against it. It makes programs very lazy. You know, they say, what is it? Oh, yeah, it's that one. How many arguments have you got? It makes them lazy, but damn, it works, and it makes people buy stuff. And so all the developers I use, especially the Microsoft developers, who really want to get a job over it, rely on this stuff.
It would at least encourage developers to use longer variable names.
Well, I mean, control P stuff. I mean, that's just already in Vim, you have automatic completion.
Yeah.
And that's not well publicized, it's just a spoiler feature. So I mean, if you type A and you type control P, then you'll get and you've got the correct setting, you'll get like a menu of all possible completions in the current buffer.
Well, you can do it different ways. Actually, I use Control N mostly.
Whatever
you want.
But you know, but this is all about configuring completions and compiled modules that you link to.
I think on the interface level, I think it will be very important to really display it as a list, some kind of drop-down list or something.
Yeah.
I think that's more intuitive and gives you a better impression of the options you have than, for instance, the current file name completion, where you can just click next file, next file, next file, next file until you have the one you want.
Wouldn't that be a generic extension to the current scheme anyway?
Oh, would be a good thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's... I think it would be a bit difficult to implement. Not impossible.
Yeah.
To have some kind of pop-up window for that list, so you can scroll through it or whatever. You have an overview of the possible options. Because currently, if you do completion, you can only see the current completion and maybe how many others there are.
Yeah,
but that's it. You have to go through them all to find the one you're looking for. You might go one too far, things like that.
Indeed. But if you
of course, if you're using a GUI version of Vim, it's easy to bring up a pop-up window with alternatives. But it gets complicated if you're just typing and suddenly the pop-up window comes there.
Yeah.
You don't want to grab the mouse to do something. if you're using an Xterm, it gets even more complicated. So you can imagine that it would be a lot of work to do that right. And I mostly use an Xterm myself, so I wouldn't be satisfied if it doesn't work in an Xterm.
I wouldn't, definitely not. I think one of the beauties of Vim is that you can use it in an Xterm and in a graphical interface, and everywhere you want, you get the same editor.
That's right.
But I think with things like ncurses, it should be very well possible to create another window on top of the editing window.
What version of ncurses on what system?
Yeah, good point.
I don't want to use ncurses because of that reason. There's too many incompatible versions around, even versions that crash Vim. I have to, in configure, there's a few lines that if it's this version of ncurses, skip it because it doesn't work. I don't think we want to go in that direction.
No.
You should default to Well Menu, or something like Well Menu, but when people say IntelliSense, that's, I think it's a trademark.
Yeah.
It means a thing.
Yeah.
It means it's something you can go by. And if it's going to work exactly like that, then yeah, you're going to be tighter, the pop-up window's going to appear. That's a configurable delay. You know, delay since in the last bit something, and then the window appears. And then you can up and down with your cursor if you want. But IntelliSense means a thing. Or else you're going to give people things that they don't want. If somebody's asking IntelliSense, people vote for IntelliSense. They know what they need.
Actually, I don't think we can use the word IntelliSense.
No.
it's just a way of talking about it. But if that
word has been used, I think, isn't it? No, it hasn't. In brackets, IntelliSense. Yes, it has. So, you bought it.
I don't know if it's a trademark.
I think it's something that was introduced, that was introduced by Microsoft, so they're bound to have a trademark or whatever on it.
We'll find a new title for it.
Oh, yeah.
What about using the CTags feature for that? I mean, CTags. I mean, Exuvian CTags can do parse array throughout languages, and right now it probably just puts the what function is defined, but it could as well put what parameters are defined for that function.
Actually,
and a lot of code is already implemented there, so it sounds to me like a lot of rewriting and maybe it can be reused.
Actually, I think now I think put it in the microwave. I don't know, I'm talking, I can't eat. Put it in front of everybody's nose, let them smell it.
Public domain.
Thanks for the interruption.
Schaffe dance with you.
Actually, I think the completion script that's on the website now, I think it's also called IntelliSense or something like that. I think it's using the tags file for that. And the main reason should be that tags are very fast. Looking up tags is very fast. And it has already been implemented for quite a few languages. Of course, exuberant C tags is what I'm referring to, because the original C tags only did C.
Yeah.
sentence.
But exuberant syntax not only does it for several languages, you can also remember for a member of a class what class it belongs to.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, so that's information we need. Actually, we were talking about Java, Python, TCL, TCL, which are languages that are sort of interpreters. There you can start the interpreter and use the interpreter to get information. For a C program, you can't do that. You have to look into header files.
Mm-hmm.
And if you compile something like GTK program, you know how long it takes to look through the header files. So for interactive work, I don't think you can do that, to look through all the header files.
So you have to compile the header files to have some...
You need something to do that looking up in a compiler kind of way, or a syntax kind of way.
It should do that dynamically. Not like when you... I have only taken a glimpse at syntax, but as far as I know, you just run a command and then it builds some kind of index file of the source code. Well, it should do that more or less automatically. I mean, when I edit a file, I save it, I go back to some other file, and I want the completion to be current. Not to rerun some program every time I edit a file.
You want a trigger on the write of the file.
Yeah. Again, Eclipse doesn't solve this problem. You know, Eclipse is an events model, and every time you can subscribe to certain events, and you as a plugin can subscribe to events published by other parts of the infrastructure. And the file save event is used, for example, if you're looking at a structure diagram of your program, class structure diagram, it will dynamically change when you save the source code, and it's an incremental change. This is the thing.
That's a good
thing. Because you're not recompiling the whole source code, which I think syntax has to do. I could be wrong there.
Well, you can run syntax whenever you save a file. It's not really complicated to implement.
It's an events mechanism. Something to kick off something to.
Who that is? Yeah.
We already have auto commands for opening files, so.
Oh yeah, you can use auto commands, but. You know, that's already going to implementation as well.
Yeah.
It was already talked about that it has BIM has auto-completion now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if there is something that can't be auto-completed, then it's something new. So, shouldn't that be a trigger to start doing the whole BTEX thing again?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know,
that's difficult.
Where it potentially goes and compiles the whole program just to get a little language.
Well, you could maybe do a diff.
But no, that's getting complicated. But
okay.
The idea is if you, for example, edit a header file in one window and edit the source file in another window, you write the header file with a change member of a structure or something, and you go back to your source file, you immediately want to see that completion there.
Yeah, okay.
So I think that's logical.
I mean, you have to, you know, put the implementation perfect. Programming language onto the site, otherwise you become. And by which I mean you write great compilers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely want to avoid, including lots of heavyweight things. Of course, Vim will grow. That's unavoidable. Because everybody wants new features. You can see it on the list.
Yeah.
I think there was an item that says stop adding features. Oh, it's actually the last one. Yeah.
How much does that cost in Vim?
So, you know, the opinion of most people is that we do want more features, which means Vim will grow, but it will not grow more than computers grow, that memory grows, use speed grows, so it grows a bit slow.
It keeps getting faster and better.
Yeah. So if you really have an old computer, you might want to use an old version of Vim.
And you can disable features compile time.
You can disable features. But that's a tough decision, though. You might want those features.
Yeah.
So you better buy the computer then.
Yeah, indeed.
Anyway. Are we going to do more about IntelliSense completion, or shall we pick another one?
Yeah, pick another one.
Let's pick another one.
Do you have a couple of annoying bugs?
Actually, there's not too many annoying bugs at this moment. Something that annoyed me is that I get a patch that seems to be a very nice addition. For example, the KDE interface that's using the Qt library.
Mm-hmm.
I said, ah, nice, now we can have KDE programs with embedded Vim widget.
Yeah.
Ah, that's great. But if you look into how it's implemented and how it's working, for me, it's picking the wrong font, so the display is wrong. Other people complain the Asian languages can't be typed. Other people complain about this and about that. And there's no maintainer. Nobody sends me bug fixes. That can be quite annoying.
Yeah.
So the problem is I hesitate to dive into KDE libraries, Qt libraries, to do it all myself because it's taking a lot of time. I didn't write that code, so that's a handicap. So I'm really hoping that somebody picks up and sees the messages on, there's a mailing list for it, KDE something. But I really hope that somebody picks it up where others left it, and especially for things like Asian languages support. People in America are not interested, and I can't really understand what the problem is.
But wasn't that the same thing with GTK2?
Yeah, GTK2...
When it was finally, before it was integrated, there was a lot of support, and when it was integrated, the person who integrated it was...
Yeah, the person
disappeared.
Who did all the work on GTK, I think it was 2.
Yeah, it was 2.
He really disappeared into nothing. Nobody knew who he was.
Okay.
Fortunately, there's enough people using GTK to send me a few patches now and then. So, and actually I'm using GTK version myself, and it's working reasonably well.
Yeah, but it was so weird. He was very actively on the list, and when it was finally integrated, he disappeared.
Finished.
I don't know if he died, but...
I don't think so. I think he was using not his real name for that.
I think it is now a part of the official KDE release. I mean, if you install KDE, it's part of it.
You get
KDE 3. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It should be like in a maintenance mode. I mean, they should fix parts.
Yeah, they should.
They should. Yeah. Well, it means also a lot of users theoretically, because you get it if you install KDE.
Anyway, let me not complain about things that annoy me. It's not very useful.
Just the library that you have on the website, that's all an easier sort of. I think it's a. Although it's not high on the code list, that's because a lot of people just use the stuff and don't do it. And it's kind of a really cheap way to get new features and new buttons. I think you understand quite complex structure and source technology. But you don't need to understand that, they just need to write some
script. Let's talk a bit about Vim script language, because I found it interesting myself. I've always started with it to keep it really simple and easy, just the minimal things. And said, well, if you want to use something complex, use the Perl interface, use the Python interface, use something else, use an external program. But what seems to be happening, it doesn't pick up. People use the Python interface for one thing, then drop it because it doesn't work on a Windows system that doesn't have Python. And to cut a long story short, people want more Vim scripting, more powerful Vim scripting. And I like Python quite a bit, especially the way that it uses data types. So what I'm thinking about is to add a list data type and a dictionary data type. So if you don't know Python, a list is simply a list of things. The things can be anything. So it's just ordered, so you can count them 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. You can append an item, you can delete an item halfway, and things like that. And a dictionary is a bit more complex. It's an associative array, basically. So you can have an index that is a word or a number, anything, basically. Anything that's constant. And with that you can do a lot of things. So those are the things that I think of adding. And once you have those things, you can make your scripts much more powerful. And I think also for the IntelliSense completion, you can use those types to write your scripts much more compact and more powerful. Not going into details how it works. Let's basically assume it works like it does in Python. Would you like to see that? Yeah.
I haven't done any Vim scripting, but I do know Python, and I do know that I like those features. So
okay.
Especially also the fact that you can say for item in list, do anything.
Yeah, that loop thing is for variable name in a list, and then it goes through the whole list, and it's just one line.
Yeah.
And you can do so many things with that. Actually, I don't think you need a lot of loop kind of structure. Looping through a list is what we need. But then, what kind of list? You can have a list of keywords, you can have a list of numbers, you can have a list of anything to loop through, a list of objects kind of things. Actually, that's one thing I'm discussing with a guy in Germany, is how you can use dictionaries for a kind of object-oriented programming in Vim script language. And we have been discussing it, and you can get quite far with it. Even though you're not really an object-oriented language, you can use the dictionary to pretend you are. And keep it simple, keep it real simple. And, well, actually I have quite a bit here, but I can't really explain by words. By the time I get to something that's not as messy as this is, I'll send it on the Vim dev list so people can give reactions, response. To ask him something.
Sure. One thing I really like for scripting in Vim is taking out of the whole mess there is with a lot of options, the master box, G defaults, if anybody says that, I break a lot of scripts break.
Mm-hmm.
I really like functions or entire scripts to be able to do in standard Vim situation. You have the save options that a lot of plugins use at the moment. You have a lot of features there. But basically, if you need to reduce that, and there's a lot of loopholes that you have to be aware of if you want to do it right for every occasion you can think of. There's a few options like this keyword that user may tweak to his length, that may not have to be set, but in general have sort of a sandbox-like environment.
So what would possibly work is that you have a function or anyway, a command where you can say what runs here always runs with the default option settings.
For instance.
The whole default thing. And when I add a new option, it doesn't matter because all the other ones are still the same. You don't have to save the value, you don't have to restore the value.
Yeah.
And that's a very useful remark. It's not in the votes list.
I mean, that's usually when I go equals, that's where I see it breaking down.
That's right. I always say don't touch the magic option, for example.
Yeah.
Because if you switch magic off, nobody expects that, so things start breaking down.
But how many people use SNO magic instead of substitute? Just assume that it's
right. So it works until somebody has a strange configuration where the option has different value. And it's especially true when you're adding new options. And of course, I try to avoid it, but sometimes you just have to add new options. And what's a good example is the Perl expression, Perl regular expression option that people want. So people want an option that say, oh, now I switched the option on, and all patterns are Perl patterns. But if I would implement that option, somebody would switch it on, then all the scripts that are currently using patterns will break. Because they're not Perl patterns. So, in that case, your idea to say sort of protected area with all default option settings. You don't have to save current values, you don't have to restore them. You know what option settings are.
It does get more complicated. You need some kind of context for which options to choose. For instance, window management. You may not really be doing much with Windows in this context, but if you do open a window, you may want split below to work as it is. Or you may need that a user's instruction language oriented options are set. So you may actually need a few contexts that can be fixed to allow for other things that you're not really worried about to happen as the user would generally like them.
Sometimes that's the whole point of options. Sometimes the whole point of options is very generic code that changes according to the language being edited because of the options.
Yeah.
So there's a difficult decision actually.
Yeah, but that's why I see some options in groups that you may not really care about and which the user really would like to set to something that he needs.
Yeah.
Whereas some are more related to text processing, which I mainly do. And there you really need them to be fixed to get a stable script.
I mean, it's keyword. Would that be an example you would want? I think that's a perfect example of something that should be allowed to change depending on the context in which the script is being run.
Yeah, but it also depends on what you need your script to do at times. So it really can depend.
Yeah.
And that's a way you need some context that you can put in context where you can fix them.
Okay.
So you can't just make an entire sandbox of the thing either.
Yeah.
But also, performance might be a problem. You want to save all options balance and restore them. That simple. Anyway, we're running quickly through time here. We have about maybe 10 minutes left, actually less. So I want to ask you something, something to discuss right now. Nobody? What shall we do the last 10 minutes? What shall we talk about?
Integrating graphics.
Integrating graphics? Oh, actually, there was a nice suggestion on the list, actually, that got pretty serious, about implementing a whole widget set in Vim. Because it started with something like, oh, I want to put up a dialogue, and not just five choices, but I want to put up a list box and things like that. Oh, but you can do it. You just take this widget set, add graphics to it, pictures, and you know, the discussion goes way.
Well, then I say, well, okay, get Python to write a script and use PyGTK to get some interface going.
But why not use it with WX Python? Or use TCLTK? Use Java?
Whatever. But what I'm thinking about is a lot of typing I do is on LaTeX, and especially when you're writing mathematical formulas, it could be nice to have just the formula rendering above or below or wherever you're typing at that moment.
Actually, one thing that I've thought about, and I've tried to do that in my app project, maybe you have heard about it, is to make an interface to make that possible. So don't do it inside Vim, but sort of interface with a viewer and have the interface at what to render, to display, and also position it somewhere. And if you click somewhere in the view, you get something back that it was somewhere there in the text. So that kind of interface would make that possible.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah.
I always love modularity.
Yeah.
So
yeah. The only problem is I haven't figured out the interface yet. But it should be possible.
Yeah.
A little bit more. You can do it.
Well, join the film dev list. And
okay.
We'll see.
Ask you something about the undo tree. Sometimes I use MVI systems where there's no Vim. And the one thing I prefer MVI over Vim is undo something, it's with multiple dots, I mean, and then you go back. With the undo, then you switch to the direction where you're undoing, and then you go forward again.
Yes.
And with Vim, I sometimes have I'm undoing something, then redoing, and I accidentally hit the dot, and I lose a lot of stuff from the tree. Is that what you mean by this, or
yes.
Is it even more complex?
Well, the point is, currently undo, you're making change, and you can undo, and then you can redo your changes. But once you do a different change, the rest of the redos are gone, vanished.
Yeah.
Then you're taking a different route, and you can never go back again to those changes that you did. So if you accidentally hit a key, I know there's a few examples of people that did that and lost a lot of work because the undo functionality they expected to be there didn't work because they made a change somewhere halfway in between. And that can be, for example, if you paste some text that does strange things. So the idea of an undo tree is that you remember every change and unchange or undo. And actually that's quite simple, because it's already done that way. And all the changes from all the changes you make are stored, and you can go back, so the functionality is there. And if you're making a branch by making a different change, what currently happens is that you just delete a part of a tree and you override it with something else. It's very simple to just keep that part of the tree. It's easy, just keep it there.
And then
you just have to need to make a mechanism for the branches. And what's most difficult there is how do you select between the branches? If you undo, it's easy. You just, the tree goes like that, so you always go one direction. But if you redo, you have to make choices. What branch do you take? That's the difficult part about that feature. How to make a choice between the alternatives and changes you have made in the past.
And that put it in the web browser as well. In the web browser.
In the web browser. Display the tree. Yeah, then you get into the graphic thing again.
You said that changes are in the redo list.
Yes.
How are they actually stored? Are they stored as commands, redo, or as the change text that was done?
No, in a very old version, they were stored as commands.
Yeah.
And then you would have to undo it, you would have to use a different command. For example, instead of a delete, you would use a paste.
Yeah.
That got so complicated to do that for every command, so that was dropped. And now it's saving whole lines. So if you're making a change somewhere, it's saving those lines that you change.
Uh-huh.
And those are stored in allocated memory, so it's not very efficient. Easy to do.
So how does that then work, for instance, if you have a substitution on the selected lines in the buffer?
Yeah.
How, and you go back and redo another change, for instance, in the middle of that?
Yeah.
Would those changes, those then have to be applied to those as well, or how do you keep track of that?
Just save all the lines that are changed, okay. And when you undo them, you save the line that is unchanged. So you sort of swap two versions, the old version and the new version. So undo and redo is actually the same thing, you're just swapping lines. And it's simple to keep that managed. The problem is to keep all the pointers in the right direction. So it's really a matter of doing it. Yeah, that's not a difficult
one. User interface problem, multi-level undo, what about like a switch that says I want now to undo, but not the way where you go back and forward, but just where undo is like a step forward, so that when you undo, you know, you replay everything what you did do on the screen.
Yeah.
So you just walk the tree again like you did. So you don't need any fancy selection mechanism. You just say, okay, now I want to go back to exactly the way I walked. So you replay. I think that would solve the problem of backing up from a mistake. I can say, okay, whoops, I did delete the branch. Now I want to go back, but following everything.
Actually, I think if you put it visually, you have the tree with choices. You can go that way, that way, that way. Of course, going back is easy. Then you go down a little bit, but then you might want to go sideways, like alternative versions. The only problem is that sometimes you have one change, sometimes you have three changes, and for you it seems like that's going sideways.
Meaning you can just walk the tree with all the path that you did take until now. I mean, now you see something on the screen.
But you don't want to go to all the versions, because those are maybe thousands. So
it
you
means
don't want to see all the versions before you find the one that you wanted. You need to somehow give a direction where you
want
to go.
Well, it would fix the part. I think this multi-level undo is there only to fix the problem of this case where you type something and then you lose a part of the branch. So this would be solved because I just need to be able to go back. Maybe it will take me 2 minutes, but otherwise it's very complicated to find again this branch. It's a very difficult model to visualize at this level. This would be kind of easy, and at least come back to a point, you know, you do undo until you see again your text.
Yeah.
Maybe you did delete a big chunk and then you do this special undo, this history undo change.
Can you perhaps write it down and explain, define how it works, really? So it's not vague and, you know, a woolly description, but really, if you do this, then you get that, if you do this, you get that. Could you describe it that way and send it to the mail list?
Okay.
That would be very useful.
Yeah.
Okay. Then others can maybe kick in and get comments.
Okay.
We're out of time actually, but there's so many ones.
But the problem is you might need them, but I think it's very useful for all those people who lost a lot of codes because when they were undoing things, they were making a mistake by hitting the wrong key. What you might want is give me back my screen as it was 10 minutes ago. Because 10 minutes ago, I had this code on my screen. And well, that's the code I want.
Okay,
so if you add a timestamp maybe to the screen, code there can test what I'm in. So
if you've got a good
translates to
create
any time
for your cat. If you've got branches on a tree, you can always go to the furthest point of any one of those branches.
Sorry?
If you've got branches on a tree, you can always go to the furthest point of any one of those branches.
Okay.
So if I go up here and I change my mind to come back and go up here,
yeah.
I go, oh shit. Now if I go back, I can't go up this tree anymore. Why? Can I go here? Can I at least remember where I was?
And if you have a branch then there,
yeah,
then you can say,
after
the
time
I was there.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's a good remark. So organize is not only just like a tree, but also in time.
Yeah. That's linear.
Somehow everything is done chronologically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you're the only person working on the
fact. Yeah. That's right. So you can actually walk the tree like you're
walking
doing it in backwards in time.
Yeah.
That's what he meant as well.
Those are remarks.
I didn't get it, sorry. It's getting late. Okay, anything else you want to talk about right now? Yeah, okay.
Oh.
Last chance. Sorry.
Okay. Well, just to add on, to me that's...
No, we had that subject.
Okay.
I want a different subject.
I'm always embedding. Embedding them.
Yes.
Making it power there's a widget somewhere.
Yeah, that's the third point on the voting list,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What about it?
How?
I'd love it.
Well, we have Windows.
I think that the problem there is that it's different for every GUI library.
Yeah.
But still, you can see common things and design something. So, actually, you already have the remote control, which is quite a primitive. But if you put that inside a window, the KDE version worked like that for a while before they had the real KDE version. Well, it's third on the voting list, so I should really think about it.
I'd really love it.
And I've not looked into it yet, so if there's good suggestions, welcome. These for different GUI libraries, like how would you do it for Windows? How would you do it for GTK? How would you do it for KD or Qt? And then if I have an overview of that, I can see the common things. And the common part and the library-specific part, we might get somewhere.
I'd really love to have it embedded inside Mozilla.
Yes.
But, yeah. Indeed. But when I have I always have double W
mm-hmm.
or in my text area.
Yeah, it happens to me.
Yeah.
You've been in Gmail.
Okay. It's 5 minutes past 10. We're supposed to stop at 10. The rye is kicking us out of the building. So, but maybe if you're around the conference tomorrow, you can see me. Okay. Thank you all for being here.